From the KTOO Newsroom, I'm Rasha McChesney with this news. Juneau's power company is preparing to test its disaster plan should a 168-foot hydroelectric dam fail and flood a largely commercial district near the city hospital. As Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick reports, federal regulators say the century-old Salmon Creek Dam is safe, but release little information to prove it.
This coming Thursday, an area north of downtown Juneau will hear this.
Siren test every year, but this is the big one.
That's Debbie Driscoll, an Alaska Electric Light and Power Company executive in charge of community affairs. She says this year's test is part of a five-year drill involving federal, state, and local authorities.
And this provides a complete test of the emergency action plan to determine if the plan is adequate to deal with an emergency arising from a failure of the dam.
The Salmon Creek Dam was finished in 1914 by the Alaska Gastineau Mining Company. At the time, it was the tallest in the world, and it's been in operation since, generating about 6% of the community's power and producing a third of its drinking water. Modeling of what would happen in the event of a major earthquake or other disaster shows a flood zone of mostly commercial buildings about 3 miles north of downtown.
And although Bartlett Regional Hospital itself is above the floodplain, the traffic to and from the hospital passes through the floodplain.
The hospital only has one road in and one road out, and that's led Juneau resident Randy Sutak to write to regulators seeking answers about the dam's condition.
My interest is I have a wife that works in the hospital area, and I started wondering one day, what would happen if? So I started writing emails and not getting answers.
That's him addressing Bartlett Hospital's board earlier this year.
If an earthquake takes out the dam, then an earthquake is also going to do a lot of damage to other buildings, we have to guess. And if we can't get those people to the hospital, then shame on us, because we have forewarning.
Juneau city officials say they rely on federal regulators to ensure the dam is maintained properly and doesn't put the community at risk. To be clear, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission also says the dam is safe. In response to Coast Alaska's questions, it released a letter its regional engineer wrote to Sutak dismissing his concerns. And Driscoll says the utility keeps the reservoir's water level at 35 feet below the dam's crest to reduce pressure on the concrete structure.
The dam, which is 47 feet thick at the base and 6 feet thick at the top, is in very good condition. It's a solid dam.
The concrete was last rehabilitated in 1967. Core samples were taken that year to inspect its condition. The next time core samples were drilled out was in 2011. Consultants recommended new samples be drilled every 10 years. So this year, Salmon Creek Dam would be due for more tests. But it's not clear if that will actually happen. Federal regulators didn't answer questions about this, but AEL&P released an excerpt from a report from a different consultant that said new concrete samples could wait until 2037. In the meantime, the private utility is updating its modeling for extreme rainfall and other weather events to keep its federal license current. Many of these details, in fact, most of the reports dealing with inspections, safety, and emergency planning, aren't freely available to the public. There's a federal rule that exempts critical energy infrastructure from disclosure. FERC says the rules date from the aftermath of the September 11th, 2001 attacks. But veteran journalists say the reluctance by regulators to share information goes back even further.
The argument that I've heard from dam security people is that, well, the terrorists are out there night and day hunting for the things in our infrastructure that would cause the most damage and harm.
Joseph A. Davis is an editor with a Society of Environmental Journalists. He's written about the federal rules that shield dams, pipelines, and other energy infrastructure from scrutiny as far back as the 1990s.
But it's also true that there have been virtually no terrorist attacks on dams in this country in the last century of dam building, and there have been many fatal dam failures from bad engineering, bad maintenance, and bad weather.
The most recent high-profile dam incident was near Oroville, California. Nobody was hurt, but nearly 190,000 people were evacuated when that dam spillway failed in an area north of Sacramento. Regulators insisted up to that point that the dam was sound, and the incident caused some soul-searching on how it had been allowed to happen. A congressional report recommended that the federal regulator do a better job of analyzing risks of its around 2,500 licensed dams.
You know, I think in general there has been a reluctance, a somewhat human natural reluctance to want to share information about unsatisfactory performance.
Martin McCann is director of the National Performance of Dams programs at Stanford University. He says utilities, unfortunately, aren't like airlines. When a plane crashes, there's public scrutiny and transparent reporting of lessons learned.
Slowly, the industry has begun to see the value of this, but it's been slow, and there is not an awful lot of, I'll call it, engineering detail that's available for enough of these incidents that we can fully leverage that information.
FERC says it's willing to open its files, but only if people sign non-disclosure agreements that carry legal consequences if the contents are shared. Davis, the environmental journalist, says for watchdogs and safety advocates, that's not workable.
It defeats the purpose of journalism, which is to inform the public.
Freedom of Information Act requests filed by Coast Alaska for the dam's safety and inspection reports over the past several years remain pending. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
As a super contagious strain of the coronavirus sweeps across America, there are no mask or vaccine requirements for state and Anchorage city workers. That's left a patchwork of protections and policies, and according to unions, some workers are scared as the new strain threatens vaccinated Alaskans. Nat Herz from Alaska Public Media has more.
Jake Metcalf, who heads Alaska's largest public employee union, has been hearing about a lot of workplace problems from his members over the past few days. At the Pioneer Home in Fairbanks, there's a COVID outbreak, and Metcalf says members are concerned about being asked to reuse their N95 masks. In Juneau, he's hearing complaints about inadequate mask wearing.
It's just a lot of people getting sick and a lot of people having to deal with the fear of getting sick. And so that's got a lot of our members really anxious.
The state of Alaska employs some 15,000 people, and Republican Governor Mike Dunleavy has declined to require them to wear masks at work. Among Metcalf's members, some are worried about catching the virus and bringing it home to their unvaccinated kids. Others are concerned about working with unmasked colleagues in confined spaces. The central problem, Metcalf says, is not enough communication about what the administration is doing to keep workers safe, particularly because of the contagiousness of the new variant.
People feel like it's an emergency. And, you know, until there's some sort of communication that we're going to have a safe workplace, I don't see that anxiety level decreasing at all.
Republican Governor Mike Dunleavy is still ruling out a mask mandate. And at a news conference last week, he suggested that state workers could protect themselves through voluntary masking and vaccination.
I would ask that people not be fearful, but have a conversation with their doc to really figure out the best way to approach this virus.
If state workers are still worried about getting a breakthrough case of the virus and bringing it home to unvaccinated family members, he says,
we've always allowed individual workers who have special circumstances, special cases, to have conversations with their supervisors to see if there could be changes to the way they work.
Metcalf, the union representative, says some employees have jobs they can't do from home. He also says it's not clear how much supervisors are making accommodations for workers who want them. In Anchorage, meanwhile, police union officials say members haven't made specific complaints about working conditions under new mayor Dave Bronson, but they note that a newly updated department policy allows unvaccinated officers to keep working even if they've been exposed to COVID. Deputy Chief Gerard Aslin says APD has to balance the interests of Anchorage residents and APD employees with the department's need to keep functioning.
And all of those things taken as a whole lead us to believe this is a responsible way to approach it for everybody involved.
Aslin says he understands if people are concerned about coming into contact with an officer who is exposed to the virus. But, he says, the department has been tracking how many of its exposed officers end up actually getting COVID, and it's a very small number. Allowing exposed, unvaccinated workers to stay on the job doesn't align with CDC guidelines, but Aslin says the risk is hugely reduced because anyone who chooses to keep working has to wear an N95 mask and social distance when possible.
When you take that limited window and then you couple it with the idea that they are also going to be wearing an N95 during that time, the risk of exposure to others is minuscule.
Vaccine requirements for Anchorage workers are not on the horizon anytime soon, as Anchorage Mayor Bronson says he won't push the shots. Governor Dunleavy's position is the same. The Anchorage Police Department isn't even tracking its vaccination rates, Aslan says, though union officials say they hear they're above 70%. In Anchorage, I'm Nat Herz.
That's it from the KTOO Newsroom. If you're looking for more local or statewide news, visit us on the web at ktoo.org.